Hello and welcome to Story Selling, the series where we're going to be exploring the skill of effective product storytelling within the field of product marketing. Each episode, we're going to focus on one of the four different stages of the storytelling process: the story, the speaker, the listener, and the response. In this episode, we're going to be focusing on the speaker. So looking into the identity of your individual brand to make sure you deliver with a unique tone of voice. For this, I am joined by Matt Deherty, the head of product marketing at Gymshark and a master at shaping and delivering unique product stories. Very happy to be here again, recording another episode of Product Storytelling for the Product Marketing Alliance, the series where I'm trying to understand a little bit more about how you create great product stories, and what better way to do that than to speak to the people who actually have spent their lives actually creating these stories. And very happy to welcome one of them in Matt. Matt, how are you doing?
Very well. Pleased to be here, Elliot. Thank you.
Thank you for jumping on a call with me. We speak a lot about this type of stuff, so this is easy for us. And I had a little think about what could be the key subject for us to talk about. What came to mind was the idea of identity. Whenever you create a product, you know, one product story might work well for one brand and then not for another. So then really one of the most key parts of creating story is actually making sure the voice of the person who you're speaking through. And I actually think you're a perfect person for that, because you have worked for two brands with very distinct voices. And one of those brands is, I think most people in the world own at least one product from them and have got a very distinct brand voice. And so I think you have a really good understanding of that difference. So maybe that's a great place to start, as you can update and tell us a little bit more about your career in product creation.
Yeah. So the company you're referring to is Nike. I used to work there for over 13 years. I'm now currently at Gymshark. I'm actually in the Gymshark podcast studio right now. The first brand, you're right. I don't think there's many people in the world anywhere that don't know know the brand Nike. So you have that massive benefit. As a product marketer, you don't necessarily need to tell people who the brand are. There's a huge awareness in the first place. That's different to Gymshark. We've got a long way to go there. But there's still a battle internally. There's still a problem around exactly what story we're trying to tell when we're building a product. It's different in a way at Nike. They've got so many products that you have to think about how exactly are we going to position every single one of those across whichever category it was. When I was working there, the last role I worked in was within North America on NFL. We call it football there, but American football for probably most people listening. There's a very clear and defined consumer there. It's majority of people are buying are fans of the game and they support a team. That's quite easy. It's very different to Gymshark, where we're kind of really, I think it's people get from the name, they know we're a gym brand. But we still got a long way to go to define clearly exactly what that is. So yeah, that's my mindset has shifted completely in my career. I've come from a company where it was completely dictated and understood to a place now where it's kind of free and open to be decided and discovered.
Yeah, it's funny, we're from the same hometown, but I was at the other side of the sports industry at Adidas, and that's where I began my product creation career. And Adidas really gave me a really clear understanding of how to create product, and even there's things that I do today, even now that I'm not in the sports industry, that I still use. For example, we were given a brand book, which is about how to create like certain product rules. One of them was test, test, and test again. One of them was the athlete is always right or first. So these things have stayed with me. I would have thought that starting at Nike, we probably would have had something similar. Was there a process of taking product managers or product marketers, and did you have something drilled into you to make you understand like this is how we create Nike product, or is it just more through the culture?
There was a set of maxims when I was there. I don't remember the exact order and where they were, but I remember one of them was that the consumer decides was one. So the answer to your product decision-making process has always has to be underpinned by a consumer need. I assume that's exactly the same everywhere. Everybody starts with their target audience. Another one of those maxims was that Nike's a brand, and I think like that was probably higher up in the priority list. I think first and foremost, you need to make sure that the brand message and mission was held up and held true, and then you overlay what does the consumer want. One of the things that is like an eternal battle is what is the consumer currently asking for, and where are we actually trying to take the consumer? A lot of the time, it's classic sort of design. When you're working with designers, you'll recognize this is sometimes part of the journey that you're going on is like we're educating the consumer about something in some cases they don't even know they need yet. Mm. And Nike are a great example of doing that, like marketing and storytelling in a way and saying, here's something you didn't know you needed yet. I was always fascinated by how they managed to do that.
Yeah, I always think of that as the difference between creating demand and chasing demand. And it happens right. A lot in the sports industry where, saying like we're creating something in a running shoe. Like right now you have carbon plating, which is in the Nike running shoe. And then I was in meetings where suddenly all of the retailers wanted to know is that does it have carbon plating in it? Not that they thought it was good, but it got into the trend that you needed to have a carbon plating in, and then that trend to take off. And then every other brand is creating their own version of that story. And obviously whenever you're second to the plate, your story is never going to be authentic. So that's really where I completely agree. And Nike do a fantastic job of being the first to the market to create that demand. It's really interesting the position you're in now, because Gymshark has got so much positivity and opportunity floating around it at the moment. But I suppose you don't have some of the things that would have helped you in the past with the brand, where you could actually help tell the product story through the weight of the brand. But at the same time, it's an amazing opportunity for you to define what that story is. You must be working very closely with your brand colleagues when it comes to telling that story, probably a lot more than you were doing at Nike. Would that be right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the role here is drastically different. One of the major benefits of working here is that it's a smaller company, and the touch points across the company are very frequent. So it's not just brand. Honestly, we're talking with customer support that are handling queries directly from the consumer. If we want to, we can talk to athletes whenever we need to. It's just a lot easier to get information. You'll probably recognize as well from your days at Adidas that the access to data, true live like information around how products actually selling in the marketplace, is always slow to receive, because you're working with retailers. You're essentially a wholesaler in the most of the time. That's completely different here. We are also the retailer, so the access to data and live information around how we're trading day to day is always on. I can log in and find out. So yeah, it's a huge benefit to being here. That's massively different. A big attraction for coming here was having access to that. Being direct to consumer is completely different when you're a product marketer.
It's really interesting, because it taps into something I've discussed on other episodes with other product marketers, is the problem of the story getting diluted. So if you're in a big company, you can come up with a great story, but then it's going to hit sales, then the retailer. And so by the time it gets to the consumer, the story that they actually get might be very different to the one that's created. And I guess what you're saying is that's the benefit that you have, that you can feel like you've got the guarantee that the story that you're trying to convey is so consistent across e-com, across retail, across when the consumer is actually experiencing the product, whatever you've created, you can be pretty reliable that that's what's going to happen. And I mean, that's an amazing opportunity to have.
Yeah, the reason for product marketing at Gymshark existing in the first place is to do exactly what you just described. We are the red thread that run the whole way through. We're set up as generalists. Our purpose is to be the one entity that starts at the idea, and we've got the insight, we want to make a product to do a certain thing and talk to a certain consumer. We're in touch with that product the entire way through until it actually arrives in the consumer's hands, and even sometimes when it gets returned to us. Mm-hmm. Try to avoid that from happening as much as possible, but sometimes it does.
I think Gymshark have seemed to tap into something which I've described before, which I think is like the holy grail of when a product becomes recognizable when you can't even see its logo. And I found myself either being in the gym, not so much these days, but being able to think, I think that's a Gymshark product without seeing it. And that's kind of what I guess all product marketers are trying to do, is because you're saying, okay, well, what makes our product different to everything else in the market? And how can we own something? How much of that is accidental, or how much of, when it comes to your creation process, is it really before you put pen to paper on a brief to create a story, is okay, like this is the problem we're trying to solve? How much is it analytical, or how much is it just marketing insight?
Visual identity is, as you know, it lies really with the design team. We get a clear design direction. So when we set out to create a physical product, we've got an idea of what we want that to look like. We want it to be clean, bold, and contemporary. I'm hoping that that's what you're recognizing and seeing. But there's also like technologies that are built in there that we want to stand for. So a large portion of our business is built on seamless products, which I'll not go into the intricacies of what exactly seamless is, but it's, I hope that product that you saw and recognized as Gymshark was seamless, because that's something we want to stand behind, and we want to tell that message and say that this is a better product than cut and sew apparel. So hopefully it was. I don't know if it was or not. I've never asked you, but it starts out with a clear design direction. Product marketing can't necessarily take credit for how the product ends up looking, but we do deliver the brief to that team and say, make sure that it meets these criteria. This is what the customer's looking for. All of that brief is based out of the insights. I've been saying recently that we're kind of where it, the discovery phase where we get our insights is always on. At Gymshark, there's not a, here's the seasonal brief from insights and here's our current information. It's always on. We are inundated with information from across the business. And then we go into a design phase, which is typically seasonal. That design phase is where we will, product will provide a brief. Product marketing will provide a brief to the design team, and it's our job to make sure that the product answers the brief in the right way. Hold our designers accountable, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny because one of the fundamental parts we've been talking about is research of creating that brief, creating the story, is how do we make sure the research is in that. And from what you're saying, I think it's interesting because you have amazing access to your core consumer. I guess even the people who work for Gymshark are essentially the consumer. And as I've talked about, there's nothing easier for a product marketer in creating product for the demographic that you are. And so that really helps. One of the things that came up from one of my other conversations is that actually sometimes we've done focus groups, and sometimes you find out the problem is the consumer doesn't always know what they want. And do you ever find that as well? Or do you take a lot of the information from those meetings as gospel? Or have you found that actually it's quite difficult to, you know, do they want to be led? Or like someone like Nike, who's telling you, this is, you don't think this is cool, we're going to make you think this is cool? Or whether it's asking you, what do you think is cool? And how can we achieve that?
Yeah, it's really difficult. So I think that the product marketer's job, I know that within Gymshark, part of our job is to translate some of those insights. So even if you have a great focus group or incredibly robust and comprehensive data, it's our job to translate that into meaningful product direction. It's not enough just to hand over the data. We need to give the design team like something actionable to get after. And you're not just reporting the facts. You also need to overlay, what's the company's strategic direction? Where are we going? What's the design direction? Where do we want to take the consumer in the future? So it's I feel like it's always going to be a blend of art and science. The older I get, the more I realize how important the art piece is. The science can sometimes be can be confusing and might tell you I'll give you an example, actually, rather than trying to prove the company I work for now is founded on something which was not a good logical idea. So Ben's insight was, I want product for guys that go to the gym that want to look great. Like, we can't get a hold of the bodybuilding type of apparel that we want. Let's go make this that works for me. Like, the logic wouldn't have said that it was worthwhile doing. There was no market for it at all. And yet we're here now with a $1 billion valuation. So it's kind of like the logic would have said, don't do it, bad idea. And yet somehow it's worked. So I think the balance of art and science is really important. It's not always going to be about insights and data. It's about choosing wisely what to do and what not to do. Great strategy comes down in the end to sometimes, what am I not going to do?
I mean, it's a great story in itself, the story of Gymshark, but I think one thing that it taps into, which kind of brings us full circle when we talk about identity, that story that you just described is authentic. It's someone who understands that I want something that isn't in the market. I understand that market and because I can't get it, I'm going to create it. And people love that. Right? People see that as there's so many great brands. And it, for me, that's where the greatest stories that are working now are those authentic ones that people only believe the story if they trust the person who's telling it. And it's easy to look at Gymshark and see that authenticity of this is, for want of a better word, bodybuilding outerwear created by bodybuilders, or at least you guys understand exactly who you're talking to. And I think that comes alive in your messaging as well, which maybe is a good thing to tap into, is how great a tone of voice your social media team and your brand team that really speak in that same way of being no nonsense, very direct, and I'd say unpretentious. I don't know if you would agree in that direction.
Yeah, firstly, I have to say that the product marketing don't necessarily decide what that all of the everything you described there doesn't necessarily live with us. We take it up to the point where we say, here's the story, what it needs to be. It's actually done here almost more by committee, if you like. There's a moment where we get together across each of those marketing channels, as you described, get together and sort of decide what is right and how are we going to approach this collaboratively. Mm-hmm. That works right now, but as we get bigger and bigger, it might be more challenging. But it's that is succeeding for us right now. We have experts within each of those channels that can figure out what's best and the best way to reach the target consumer. So it's not necessarily product market. I can't sit here and say that I'm responsible for that, but we're part in the room at the time of making sure that the story that we built into the product is still there. That's our role. Just going back to what you said about authenticity and like it not being necessarily, it's authenticity needs to be more important these days. Like, how do you feel like you can be too niche in a way these days? Like, is there any way that a brand can be too, like, if strategically, if you're talking, sorry, I'm interviewing the interviewer now, but if you try to go broad and mass, we'd be targeting in sporting terms right now, we'd be. In the sports industry, that would be like Gymshark trying to outcompete Nike or even Amazon or Gap or whatever. Right now, at a company the size that we are right now, I think it's probably more important that we actually focus on the niche and being authentic and credible rather than trying to be all things to everybody.
No, I completely agree. It's a conversation I've had a few times recently as well, as of the age of the specialist. I think there was this pattern of the generalists taking over in economies of scale and obviously advantages, and under this idea that people loved big brands. And I think that I agree that that's kind of shifting away. And being right now, what I'm looking at, I think I actually think being niche is a great thing. And it is a temptation to always go bigger, but I think there are advantages of having that in the market. And I think when you look at the sports industry, some of the most exciting and fast growing brands are the ones who know who they are.
Yeah.
The ones who have said, and Gymshark are in this position, but there are plenty more of saying, we have now got the investment and the growth to go in 50 directions. And the question is, do we want to? And I think from a product marketing point of view, that's a really interesting conversation that's happening, because ultimately, do you stick to what you're great at and become known as it? Do you expand and apply your product marketing vision, taking that same process and applying it to different areas and see what works, or something in the middle? And I think that's something that every brand goes through. But I think that's where it really comes down to that authenticity. What other areas can Gymshark do that and still be authentic? Maybe if something like swimming, could be very relevant, maybe for badminton less so. But I think that's like, it's one of the interesting conversations to have. And that's why I think the situation you're in right now is really interesting, where a brand finds that momentum and can go in so many directions. And it's really interesting to hear your viewpoint on it as well.
These are like real debates that we're, that I honestly feel lucky to be having, because you wouldn't necessarily always be part of that debate at my previous company. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of, so I'm a massive fan of the work that BrewDog do. Mm-hmm. They released a book it's got something in there. I'm going to butcher this, but they have something called their focus test. Mm-hmm. And essentially they're saying, if we can't do it better than anybody else in the world, let's not do it. And I absolutely love that. I think that just like that, carrying that with you and thinking, if we can't be number one on this and do it more authentically, incredibly than anybody else, it's a bad idea. It's just something great to carry with you.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think that's where it really, I always encourage anyone to really invest in their brand purpose, because that's when you have to go back to the drawing board and say, well, are we that or are we not? And usually when you're being successful, you don't have time to think, what are we? Because you're too busy being successful. But there has to be a point in any brand's life cycle where you take some time before you make that mark. Coming back to the idea of like product identity, it's something I like to ask everyone, and you've had a really like long career within product creation. Which are the products that you've been involved at, would you say that you feel like you really nailed, or the story at least came out really well? Is there a product that you worked on that you're specifically proud of?
Yeah, I grew up playing rugby, and part of the reason I wanted to work on product in the first place was so that I could work on Nike's rugby offering. There was a moment in time, it was 2015, I think it was, the Argentina team were sponsored by Nike, and it was actually turned out it was their 50th anniversary of a famous win over the South Africans. So it was 1965 that they played that first game and they won. And just out of pure curiosity and just trying to really understand more about Argentinian rugby specifically, because we were based in Europe at the time, myself and a designer got on a plane, flew out to Buenos Aires and spoke to the players that played in the game in 1965. Wow. And we just uncovered this wealth of information. So we visit the museum where the original jersey was hanging behind a glass cabinet. We measured the width of the stripes, color matched the blue and the white perfectly. It's not pure white now, it's sail. It's like a sort of off-white color. We spoke to the players about what it meant to actually, what it felt like to play and win in such a momentous game. Turned out one of the players, actually his son, was currently playing for the actual current Argentina team. So we had this beautiful story coming together. None of this was massively important to Nike at the time at all. But we went out on a limb and created what was a modern version. So all the current technologies you'd expect in a modern rugby jersey, but keeping as close to the original DNA as possible. So it had a collar on the jersey. Mm-hmm. The colors were exactly matched. The stripes were just perfect. And there was a couple of like real attention to details that were brilliant. Like, so we made sure that the sponsor logos, while they were still there, were the actual color of the base fabric. So the sponsor logos were there, but you couldn't really see them unless you were up close. And that took some serious negotiation with the sponsors involved. But this all came together with something in the end, at a moment on field where Argentina were playing again, 50 years later, against the South Africans again. And they came out on field in this jersey that was just, if you go back and you scour the forums for uniforms of the year, you'll find the Argentina 2015 heritage jerseys being the number one. So it's super niche. It's not massively commercial. But for me, as a guy who grew up playing rugby, seeing Argentina run out on that field wearing that uniform was unbelievable in the first place. The perfect storm was actually that the guys that played in the original game were in the crowd, and Argentina actually won again against South Africa. It was the first time they'd done it in a very long time. So that perfect storm came together beautifully for myself and the team that worked on that product. incredibly proud and an easy choice for me in my list of products that I've made that I'm most proud of. The biggest shame of it is that we didn't really get a chance to tell the story. Mm-hmm. So at a company like Nike, where there's so many amazing stories to talk about, unfortunately, rugby didn't end up being one of those that we had time or space to talk about. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't marketed. It wasn't necessarily like advertised outside of anywhere other than really the Argentina team and their own activations locally. So easy choice. There's been some other cool ones recently. Like there's an article right now in Wall Street Journal around women's flag football in the US. We created a women's football jersey, not because it made sense financially, but women's flag football in the US, there's only about 11,000 females play flag football, mm-hmm. but we did it because it was the right thing to do. We're a brand that was trying to be as inclusive as possible, and just making uniforms for the males that play tackle football or play in the NFL wasn't enough. So we did that, and it's been picked up by Wall Street Journal. It's in there this week. So it's another one that I'm quite proud of that you wouldn't necessarily notice on the grand scheme of things, but it means a lot to the people that are taking part in it.
Yeah, it's brilliant, the Argentina example, because it might not be obvious to everyone, but I'm sure those little details that you change, they mean a lot to the people who you're building that for, who are fanatics of the jersey, and they recognize it. And it's an emotional product, a football jersey. So it really makes a difference. And it taps into something, is that as a non-Argentinian person, how could you have possibly have tapped into that product creation process unless by going into the market, speaking to the people who love it, speaking to the people who wore it, speaking to the brand that you're telling the story from, which in this instance, as always with license, it's not just the brand, but also the club really that you're telling the story from. So I think it's a really good example of that. I would love to ask you from what you've learned from your career, obviously for anyone working in product creation now, is the one thing you've picked up that's made you a better product marketer in terms of storytelling? Is there a process you follow? Is there a research? Mm. Is there a way you execute a story? Is there anything that you've learned that you think could be beneficial to people at the Product Marketing Alliance?
From what I've read so far on the Product Marketing Alliance, I think this is probably not going to be uncommon an answer, and it seems like an easy answer, but consumer empathy is the obvious one. Like everything I've talked about here is about like really understanding. Now, your ability to understand the consumer these days is improving every single day. Like there's new and more intelligent ways to get information around what the consumer wants, more so than when we both started in our product creation careers. It's changed a lot. So you have the ability to find out what they want, and whether that's going and spending time in the market, talking to individuals, or doing it from behind a computer and doing it mass at scale through data, you can do it in a bunch of different ways. The thing that hasn't changed though is a consumer empathy. The thing I add about storytelling is I think storytelling isn't just about the business to the consumer. Mm-hmm. Internally, within your own company, the ability to storytell and build momentum around products and get support from the right people and the stakeholders inside of your business is equally as important in order to get stuff off the ground in the end of the day. Rallying support and rallying momentum behind campaigns that you know will resonate and you want to back is equally as important as the actual end consumer storytelling.
Yeah, I completely agree. Storytelling is a skill not just to help your products, but to also help you as a personal level, as someone who works in product marketing as well. It can really make life easier. And just to bring us to an end, yeah, I completely agree with that. Empathy. It's actually, when I'm hiring for product marketers, empathy is a quality I'm always looking for. And it actually connects very well the subject I wanted to talk to you about, identity. One of my favorite videos from last year was a combination of all of the adverts of major brands during lockdown, during COVID, and how they all use the same words, in many cases use the same color tones, they use the same piano music because they were trying to be emotional. And unfortunately, a lot of those brands weren't emotional. And then what happened is it felt unauthentic, and actually a lot of those campaigns bombed. So I think I completely agree. It's being empathetic, but being empathetic from your unique position of your identity. And that's when you'll really be able to strike a note. Matt, really appreciate you taking your time to speak to me from your fancy Gymshark Batcave podcast office, and look forward to catching up again. And thank you for your time.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.